All right, make sure you're in fellowship as we now briefly return to Genesis chapter 39, verse 1. After the verse, we're going to review the doctrine of suffering, but hopefully after the fact you'll appreciate that, because it gives that frame of reference that needs to be fresh in our minds to truly grasp Joseph in his whole situation at hand. But anyway, we begin here back in our text in 39 verse 1. The narrative on Joseph resumes, remembering back, Joseph was the subject of discussion previously in terms of his dream, his multicolored coat, etc. Then a break was given in chapter 38 from Judah and his situation. And now we come back to Joseph as the primary subject in view. Verse 1, we have Joseph's undeserved suffering here recapped, in case anyone has forgotten, since he was sold into slavery earlier on. So looking here at the Hebrew, verse 1 corrected it a little bit, nothing major here. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. You have the wow consecutive in the proper noun, Joseph, followed with the hafal, perfect, third masculine singular. The hafal form of the Hebrew is causative passive. An outside agent causes this to happen. You have the Hebrew word yarad. This thing isn't going to highlight very good with this color up here. Y-A-R-A-D literally means to descend. You would say he had cause to have been taken down to Egypt, proper noun. The Hebrew, when it says down or up, is dealing with elevation, not direction. We say down, up, two directions, south or north in our society. The Hebrew looks at elevation, going from a higher elevation here to a lower elevation of the land of Egypt. From Canaan. And he bought him, Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard. And what I changed was bringing the verb forward, as it is in the Hebrew, for emphasis. First, and he bought him. You had the wow consecutive, followed with the cow, imperfect third masculine singular, with the third masculine singular suffix, kana, Q-A-N-A-H, to acquire, to purchase, to bought him. Proper noun here is Potiphar. Saw it back in chapter 37, verse 36, as it ended that chapter, with his being sold and purchased by the same person. And then we are told what his position was, profession. You had the common masculine singular noun construct, saris, S-A-R-I-Y-S. That's an official or officer of Pharaoh, the highest authority, be the same as king in regards to Egypt. Whereas we recognize our president as the highest office for our country. Pharaoh is the name and title given for the highest office in Egypt. So Potiphar is his name. Name is often the same as their official title or job. Profession, things of this nature. And see, he held a very high position, close to the highest in command there. And he himself, then you had the common masculine singular noun construct SAR, S-A-R. He was the chief or captain, as it's translated, of Pharaoh's bodyguards, basically. You have the definite article, followed with a common masculine plural absolute noun, Thabach, T-H-A-B-B-A-C-H. Guardsmen, bodyguards, guardians, the elite guard, if you will, designed to protect Pharaoh, his home, and things of that nature. The bodyguards, the men of Egypt, you had the common, they were men of Egypt, Egyptians, Egyptian bodyguard, common masculine singular absolute, Ish, men, I-S-H, followed with the proper noun again, Egypt. And he brought him, then we're told whom he purchased it from, and from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Preposition men, followed with the common feminine singular construct yod, or word for hand, yad, from the hands of, definite article, their proper noun, Ishmaelites, sect off of Ishmael, from Abraham's line, whose relative pronoun, Asher, A-S-H-E-R, again, to take down, cause him to descend, if you will. He had the Hiphil, just simply the causative in this one, because they were the instruments bringing there. Hiphil, perfect third common plural, with the third masculine singular suffix again, Yarad, Y-A-R-A-D. Taking him down, then the adverb followed with the adverb sham there, to that place, S-H-A-M. So rereading here, verse 1, now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and he bought him, Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, from the Ishmaelites, who had taken him down there. All right, now this is verse 1. The author resumes the narrative of Joseph, ending chapter 37, having been sold into slavery, remembering back there in verse 36, they ended that chapter. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him to Egypt, in Egypt, to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So 22, now the same 22 years that lapsed in chapter 38, dealing with Judah and Tamar and that whole situation, the leveret, etc. That occurred over a period of 22 years. So now the same 22 years that elapsed in chapter 38, according to the Judah-Tamar affair, is now revisited with Joseph as the subject, beginning now Genesis 39:1. That 22-year time frame will expand through Genesis 42, verses 3 and following. That dates us around 1678 to 1656 B.C. for the chronological notation. So now, point 3, in that 22-year time span, 13 years now, elapsed for chapters 39 through 41, verse 46, to occur with the 7 years of plenty, verses chapter 41, verses 47, filling in the remainder of chapter 41, bringing in to 42, 3 and following. So, essentially, the 13 years is going to bring Joseph up to the point of what we will see here in chapter 39 his imprisonment, ending chapter 39. And then that occurs in 13 years. And then after that, his rise to his position under Pharaoh, in response to his ability to interpret Pharaoh's dream, whether Egypt's going to have 7 years of plenty, the 7 years of famine, and that 22 years then finishes out in regards to the first 7 years of plenty in that respect. The 7 years will happen, then about 2 years later that, when you get into 42:3 and following, when his brothers show up, that's about 2 years into the famine. So that's where you're at chronologically. So for, at that point, for this chronology, places Jacob's sons going into Egypt in Genesis 42:3 and following, some 2 years into the famine period. So that's how we're able to keep track of the chronology through this period. So that period of time, when they go into Egypt, by that point in time, in that 22-year time span that we dealt with Judah in chapter 38, that ends, and Judah's back with his family, with Tamar, and they head into Egypt. So five, now what the reader will witness over the first 13 years of Joseph's recording here is a roller coaster ride of suffering and blessing associated with the positive believer Joseph. And we've already dealt with this to a certain degree, at least, the difference between Joseph and the rest of his brothers in terms of spiritual orientation. In terms of positive and negative volition as believers. Now, they're all believers. Judah, who carries on the line of Christ, his spiritual disposition, as we saw, was rather faulty. And he is a representation of the very land of Judah, as it will appear prophetically, as we brought out through the leveret notation, that he's associated with in chapter 38. At the end of the First Advent, during the time of the First Advent, and the end of the Age of Israel, where Israel is in reversionism. And again, whether eventually he got his act together by implication, I would guess that he did. But there was a long period of his life that Judah was fairly maladjusted. That's in contrast to Joseph, who is given the double blessing, the double portion of blessing, and the blessing by Jacob to his sons, as will be recorded in chapter 49. So Joseph fulfills the requirement of double blessing, of being both phase one and phase two, in his example as a believer among his brothers and family here in Genesis. So Joseph is a positive believer, to put it quite bluntly, he really had his act together. His commitment to the truth of doctrine, his loyalty to doctrine, and his moral and ethical behavior is beyond reproach. As we will see, doesn't mean he was perfect. But overall, he truly epitomizes what a positive, adjusted believer, how they act and react to testing and sufferings in life in that vein. Obviously, falls in the footsteps of double blessing from his father and grandfather and great-grandfather, Jacob, Isaac, and Abraham, in the vein of being phase one, phase two positive in that sense. And we saw they were not perfect either. But Joseph truly is given a sterling preview in the Old Testament in regards to his life. But it was not all fun and games with respect to sustaining and maintaining his spiritual integrity. So, six, Joseph now, as we return back to him, serves to example the admixture of undeserved suffering and blessing phase two postulation can expect at some level. The suffering is part of the Christian life. As we saw in our doctrine of grace, God's blessing upon men, as he promised his disciples, family, friends, businesses, all these blessings he will pour upon those who follow him, who are positive to doctrine. He will provide these blessings to the proper degree in that regards, whatever, in the face of whatever they may be sacrificing otherwise on behalf of Bible doctrine and the ministry as it might be and disciples or apostles' sake. But he says also along with persecutions. All men suffer. Like I have to say that today. The question is what kind of suffering are you undergoing? Is it deserved or undeserved? And that is where the doctrine of suffering obviously is designed to refresh our memories and recognize that we will face suffering in our Christian life. And the issue, obviously, is designed to help us advance ourselves spiritually and to try to capture suffering under the undeserved category as much as possible rather than that which we deserve because of our own spiritual malfeasance. So Joseph is an example in his life. You will see his suffering that we've already been introduced and now being recapped, and then blessing that will follow behind it. The more suffering, the more blessing. So he serves as an example of this, if you will, roller coaster ride that the Christian will experience in regards to their lives in this vein. Phase two, postulation, especially at the peak of experience. So seven, one thing he does is he contradicts the Pollyanna thinking held by some believers that they must overcome if they expect to advance their Christian lives phase two, intent on being prize winners. By that, what we mean is too often it is proposed, if not outright declared, by preachers, pastors, evangelists, and otherwise, that somehow if you are spiritually in tune, that your life is going to be, if you will, a bed of roses. Your obstacles and things of this nature, suffering, will be minimal. If you're doing it right, if you're suffering in life, the whole implication, if you're suffering in life, then there's something wrong with you spiritually. Well, that may be true. It also can be nothing further from the truth than that position. And there are those out there that think, everybody's life is, if they're positive, they're part of a positive church, part of a positive ministry, everything's going to go smooth as glass all the time. See. And then when things do happen, the tests come. These types of individuals are completely and totally unprepared. And they become the emotional basket cases and spiritual basket cases in regards to trying to deal with these downtimes of suffering that they experience in life. Matthew 13, 20 and 21. In the parable of the sower, where the analogy is used, the sower being the communicator of Bible doctrine, the seed that he plants is the truth of Bible doctrine that he broadcasts in his farming endeavors on the soil. The soil is symbolic of volition. And the parable of the sower depicts different types of volition as they exist among the human race, from the unbeliever to believers who are negative, go in reversionism, to the believer, believers who do it right. And the parable of the sower, he explains it, verse 19, when anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what has been sown in his heart. This is one whose seed was sowed beside the road as he broadcast the seed in the time in which he lived on the field. They would have paths where people walked so they wouldn't get out in the field where the plants were planted. And that would become hard pan soil and seed. So that seed in the broadcast, it wasn't specific where it was spitting it out every 6 inches and, you know, 4 inches apart or whatever. They had threw it out with their hand. That was the system, agricultural system that was used back then. And some of that seed would land on that path. And the seed is pictured as becoming fodder for the wild birds, the crows, etc., to come and feed off these seeds. That represents the unbeliever who remains negative in regards to the gospel message. And they become fodder for Satan and his attempt to consume negative volition in the world under his evil appetite in that respect. And then you have another aspect of the planting process, and the one on whose seed was sown on the rocky places. This is a man who hears a word, immediately receives it with joy. Going through the field, they would have stone underneath the soil, and they were not always able to pull out large rocks, and you would have, therefore, in some places, a very thin layer of soil. It was enough for the seed, when it landed there, to germinate and sprout up as a plant. But yet, it did not have the depth of soil necessary to carry on the nourishment of the plant to bring it to full maturity and production. And that represents the believer, one who becomes a believer, their faith in phase two faith in regards to Bible doctrine immediately wanes or disappears. And that is why, yet he has no firm root in himself. See, he hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. This is a believer now that we're dealing with. That's where so many Christians fail to understand that believers can be just as big as idiots as unbelievers. A believer can do the same thing an unbeliever can do. The only thing that a believer can't do that an unbeliever does is unbelieve, because they believe. See, but that's this whole relative good mentality that the world has adopted, is how you have a relationship with God and you get into heaven. See, is how good you are. No, that's not how you get into heaven. You get into heaven by believing in Jesus Christ. Anyway, this seed, it germinates, it sprouts. It, in other words, the volition, the soil, the individual brings about to the salvation, the adjustment. But yet he has no firm root in himself, verse 21. But it is only temporary. And when affliction or persecution arises because of the word, immediately falls away. Well, the verse shows that part of living the Christian life involves suffering and persecution in regards to one's life in and of itself. And again, as I stated, everybody suffers to a certain degree. There are what we call chips in life, common human problems that every human being will undergo. Those who may live long enough, they'll suffer in regards to their health as they get older and older. Just as an example, everybody suffers, but is it glorifying God? That's the question. Or is it brought about by one's own spiritual dereliction and rejection in regards to God? No different than being blessed by God or being blessed by the cosmos. Then you have the other layer there, just to finish out the parable. 22, the one on whose seed was sown among the thorns to protect their vegetation, their plants. They would grow thorn bushes around the field to keep predators, help keep predators out. And so the seed would land over that area. Obviously, if it falls under where the thorn bushes, etc., were planted, then they would be robbed of their sunlight and maybe moisture in some cases, and not do very well, be like a wild weed in the middle of the garden, a plant trying to grow amongst the weeds in that sense. This is a man who hears the word. So that's one who believes in Christ and then attaches himself to Bible doctrine, sound Bible doctrine, for some extended period of time, long enough that they start enjoying the blessings of life that comes about for being positive. This is a man who hears the word, and the worry of the world and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. It may grow up. Maybe fairly large in regards to the size, but it does not produce the head of the wheat, the fruit otherwise that is designed to produce as a seed. And the fruit in the Bible is symbolic in regards to one's divine good production or good works. And that is a believer who is positive to a certain degree in phase two, but does not make the maturity adjustment to the justice of God in its complete form and holding to the end. And they capitulate, get wrapped up in regards to the cosmos and those things around them, and they grow lukewarm and eventually fail their spiritual advance. Then you have the final one, which pictures positive volition, phase two, that glorifies God through to the end. And the one on whose seed was sown on the good soil, this is a man who hears the word and understands it, who indeed bears fruit, brings forth some hundredfold, some 60, and some 30. We all have different niches, and we will apply at different levels. But the main thing is that these are all prize contenders. That's the emphasis on that end one. Then Revelation 2:10. So that makes it very clear that suffering is a big factor in regards to why a lot of Christians capitulate and throw in the towel and start revamping their priorities in life. Instead of being Bible doctrine as it used to be, now it's something else. Nobody likes to suffer. I mean, you like to suffer, then you're weird. But that is the fact of life. And the church was in Revelation, the church of Smyrna. They underwent as a church universal, the church in its entirety underwent severe suffering by the hands of the Romans and others, the Jews and others around them during their period of time. In verse 10, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison, become political prisoners, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the wreath of life. May die in prison, may be martyred out otherwise. Many Christians during the early apostolic and immediate post-apostolic times, as we know, were highly persecuted, used as the games for the lions and things of this nature. So this whole idea that, oh, now that I'm doctrine or whatever, my life is going to all of a sudden, everything's going to just be rosy glows, and here we go. Forget it. You will have your times of blessing, but you're not going to be free of suffering. In fact, you probably will experience it at a degree that otherwise you would not if you simply remain negative. All right, 8, while God was overseeing the events of Judah, and so Joseph here, people got to get over that idea. You know, well, my job's always going to go good. I'm going to be doing in my life exactly what I want to do or whatever, you know. That's not the issue. The issue is figuring out what God wants you to do in your life. And as we will see, Joseph's hands are going to be tied completely and totally in regards to the direction his life goes. Yet he will ultimately arise to be the second most powerful person walking on this planet at this point in time in history. Yes, we understand talent. We understand good work ethics. He will picture that, etc., etc. But God is in control. And as it is, too often, it is energy of the flesh that determines the decisions we make in regards to our life rather than truly waiting upon God. Anyway, 8, and we'll see all that. While God was overseeing the events of Judah and Tamar now, he was simultaneously watching over his servant Joseph. God was over that whole situation, as messed up as it was. And it still came about fulfilling God's plan in spite of Judah's self, in spite of Tamar's self. So 9, God is omniscient and omnipresent, is not limited, interacting in believers' lives, able to multitask, as we would call it today, controlling events in human history. Our country may look out of control sometimes. The world may look out of control sometimes. But it's never truly out of control in regards to God. He has the perfect thumb on the pulse in regards to all aspects of human history. And God is first and foremost omniscient in this vein. He knows all things. He is able to foresee perfectly all future events that will occur. He is omnipresent. As a spirit, he fills all space. So there's no place that God is not. So there's nothing that God does not know, hypothetically or otherwise. He has considered every condition, every plausible possibility that may occur in regards to his plan being fulfilled in time. And therefore, he is completely and totally prepared. And he uses his power to ensure that his plan will be completely and totally fulfilled. Every dot and iota, every T is crossed, every I is dotted, if you will, of his plan will be fulfilled according to the divine design. And there's you can't limit God in his capability of doing this, whether it's here or whether it's a brother and sister in Christ some way, we're halfway across the world. He simultaneously is controlling all things, see, in their lives. Psalm 139, 1 through 12. This is the God we serve. This is a Psalm of David, noted here, put together for the choir director. Psalms are songs. David was a musician. He was the harpist par excellence of his time, for anybody that's old enough to know who I'm talking about. Harpo Marx, that God was a beautiful harpist. He could play that thing like a bird could sing. Well, David was very accomplished. He utilized it in his defense in regards to Saul on occasion. When Saul would get under his SCA and go berserk, David had the skills in utilizing this particular musical instrument to soothe his emotions. And music can do that to you. It can also stir them up too. But anyway, so this psalm is written for the choir director. Verse 1, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. This is David's perception in regards to God. God's capability of his omniscience. There is nothing that God does not know about you, has not known about you since eternity past. That's forever. He knows the very depths of your heart. He knows us better than we'll ever know ourselves in that sense. And the positive believer, especially the positive just believer, is thankful that God knows us to such degree. Because the positive believer who practices intellectual honesty is always trying to be transparent before God and always seeking and looking to God to help, to provide mercy at a time of need, and all these other things that we face in regards to our life and trying to seek God otherwise as positive believers. Verse 2, you do know when I sit down and when I rise up. Go to bed, get up. Nothing catches God off guard. There's nothing that he doesn't see. You do understand my thought from afar. You can hide your thoughts from others, but you can't hide your thoughts from God. So don't play coy with God, like he doesn't know what your real intentions are, even though you're faking everybody else out around you. Yeah, he knows these things. You do scrutinize my path, verse 3, and my lying down, and art intimately acquainted with all my ways. You are, I said art, it's old English. And you are intimately acquainted with all my ways and knows your habits perfectly. Exactly where you're going to go, what you're going to do, what you're going to think, what you're going to say. Even before there is a word of my tongue, verse 4, behold, O Lord, you do know it all. The praise and orientation to God's omniscience. See, in the song. Even before you're going to think it, God knew in eternity past what was going to come out of your mouth or out of your mind. Therefore, he's able to perfectly construct a plan to address your volition in that vein. Even verse 5, closed me behind and before his protection and laid your hand upon me. In other words, he's prepared to intervene as necessary for his volition, as it's been in the past, so it will be in the future. His hand looks at his omnipotence and power of protection, the ability to protect. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. David is trying to wrap his mind around the greatness of God and his omniscience and his omnipotence and his omnipresence in that sense, his attributes. In verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? You can't hide from God. Even though surely in human history men are going to be doing their best to hide from God under rocks, etc. Judgment starts rolling in. Or where can I flee from your presence? Is on the presence now being highlighted. Verse 8, if I ascend to heaven, you are there. You can go to the moon, you can go to Mars, but you're not going to get away from God. If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, verse 8, in the middle of the earth, Sheol, paradise, behold, you are there. There's no space that God does not possess and occupy in regards to his creation. If I take the wings of the dawn, verse 9, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, time or day, that God fills all space and time is known as his immensity. He is immense that he is. Even there, verse 10, your hand will leave me, and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, verse 11, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be dark. 12, even the darkness is not dark to you. Darkness cannot overcome light. That's just a matter of fact. You can be the darkest place it is. All you need is a little flick of light, and it can light up an entire room. People have been in the military, been trained in that regard. I mean, some of the places that we was at, some of the LZs over in Nam, they set up on some hills, 1,200 feet up or whatever. If they smoked, they kept their hands over the deal. They said they could see the glow of that cigarette miles away. Charlie could. Charlie was our next door neighbor. The VC, the enemy. I mean, just a little flick of light. And it would get dark sometimes. Obviously, I've never seen the heavens displayed as brightly on the other end of the coin in regards to the stars, etc., as I did when I was in that country, because there was no artificial light to interfere anywhere for miles. It was just fantastic. Sometimes the year a certain parts of the year, you could look up to see the Southern Cross, and you knew in the United States they could see it. See, that was a big emotional thing. Oh, everybody at home could see this, like everybody's looking up there. Now they're out there having protests and riots. And even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. He created these things. Jeremiah 23, 23 and 24. Verse 23, he asks a rhetorical question. Am I a God who is near, declares the Lord, and not a God far off? He's everywhere all at once. Can a man, verse 24, can a man hide himself in hiding places? So I do not see him, declares the Lord. Do I not feel the heavens and the earth, declares the Lord. Again, his omnipresence with the slice of his omniscience is being extolled there. And then confer Deuteronomy 31:8. And the encouragement that Moses gives to the Jews to exhort them as they continue to face tests in life. He said in the Lord, verse 8, in Yahweh, the Lord is the one who goes ahead of you. He will be with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. Do not fear or be dismayed. God is always with you. So that's the reality. There is no excuse to act under anxiety and fear otherwise. We're told to fear no man, even though they can kill the body. You are to fear God, who can condemn and judge both body and soul into hell. That's where your real fear should rise or lay. All right, 10. Now the time reset, beginning chapter 39 here, as we get back to Joseph, is some days after his brothers sold him and Joseph been taken down to Egypt. Joseph, Yarad, Egypt. That's verse 1. So we left 37, he'd been sold to Egypt. Now we're some days, maybe a week or so, a couple of weeks down the line from that time. So 11, now from the human viewpoint perspective, Joseph was in a deplorable situation. You got to recognize there are two pools of thought, thinking, ideology, philosophies, whatever you want to call it, that man can draw upon in regards to their consideration and decision making in life. There is the human viewpoint and there is the divine viewpoint. Divine viewpoint is all that God thinks and the way He thinks, how He critiques things, how He evaluates things, what He expects, what He wants us to think, say, and do under His directive will, how He reacts in regards to negative volition under His permissive will, all these aspects of God. That's a divine viewpoint. The divine viewpoint is revealed to us in regards to the Scriptures in and of themselves, the Old Testament and the New Testament combined. We have the mind of Christ. So to think like God, that's a part of our goal in regards to growing up spiritually, is reprogramming our thinking with the mind of Christ. So if you can't think correctly, then you cannot be expected to execute correctly those things that are required or you're obligated to before God. So you've got to know the doctrine. This whole idea that floats out there among Christians that reading the Bible is not that big a deal in regards to being a good Christian, they're nothing but a bunch of spiritual morons. They're negative. That's what they are. They're negative to the truth. They may flaunt it in regards to their lip service that they love Jesus and may wave the Bible around and all these things. But you can't, you're not expected to do anything in life if you don't know how to do it. So first and foremost, you've got to come to Bible class and learn how God thinks and what He expects of us. Anything that is a contradiction to that, or distorts that, or rejects that, or adds to it, this is all part of the human viewpoint pool of thought. The world operates under human viewpoint. Obviously, there is a mixture, a divine viewpoint that is thrown in there, but generally it goes unnoticed as being such by the world in and of itself. It comes from the innate ability known as the conscience of mankind to know instinctively the difference between right and wrong, even though we may highly question that sometimes. The seared consciences that are out there. Every unclean bird, man, you just think that's what's happening. It's landing. They're landing all over the place. Well, actually, they're coming out of the closet. They've been here, a lot of them, for a while. All right. So, human viewpoint, the world, and obviously, is definitely emphasized in our culture. To become a slave is the worst thing possible that ever happened to you. And here Joseph has been sold off to slavery. A free man, otherwise. Abandoned by his brothers. Stabbed him in the back, so to speak, and sold him off into slavery. To the world, oh man, poor Joseph. Poor, poor Joseph. And we're not diminishing this whole ordeal. I mean, good grief, most of us can probably have had our responses emotionally in regards to suppression and oppression that we've had to endure for the past year. You can imagine being in his shoes and that kind of oppression. So 12, Joseph had been taken from his father's house, stripped of his favorite position in the house, deprived of his badge of honor, that was the special tunic that his father had prepared for him, the multicolored tunic, and reduced to slavery. So, the apple of his father's eye, one day, the next, on the slave train, slow train to Egypt. And what brought all this upon? 13, all this for being oriented. These are the funny points. If you don't get the humor, you're going to miss it. All this for being oriented to God's plan and having the audacity to apply in the face of antagonism by his negative, jealous brothers. And how does God treat him? And that's the way the word look. What kind of God is that? So, you know, the Pollyanna attitude, it does not work in Joseph's case. See? So, here he is. He is positive the Bible doctrine. He applies at a high level. God has blessed him for that. And the next day, it's like the rug is pulled out from underneath him. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to enlighten us to these things. In Jesus' name, amen.